That picking up okay here? I think we can hear it all right.
Yeah. Yeah, there shouldn't be much noise in the background. It's a fairly quiet place.
Oh, no, this will be fine. Let's begin then by indicating that this is Jim Boning with Dr. Norman Hackerman in his office at the Welsh Foundation in Houston. Today is Friday, February 21st, 1992. Dr. Hackerman, the last time that we talked, we had you at the point of arriving at UT in Austin.
Oh, yeah.
And you had started the Corrosion Research Laboratory within a few years after you arrived.
Actually, that same year.
And we did finish about it. You're telling me about the what it was like when you first started out there, what is now Balcones Research Center.
Oh, yeah.
We also discussed a little bit about why you chose UT and a tenure track position over a quote safer government position with the TVA. And you started right in. You published a large number of papers in corrosion very early at UT. But I was also curious about a textbook in physical chemistry that you published in 1949.
Yeah. That's pre-medical physical chemistry.
What was the origin of that? Why did you do that?
Well, there was a course at UT for pre-meds. They were kind of forward-looking. That was early in the game. And it had become evident to a number of people on the campus that pre-meds who had some background in physical chemistry, that is, more than just general and organic, might have a leg up in their studies in physiology and other things, that biochemistry that they got at medical school. And it was already established, but it didn't appear each semester. I got interested along with a fellow named Matson, F.A. Matson, theoretical chemist. I got interested in it because I took it on as an assignment. I gave the course. And Matson and I office together, and we talk about this on occasions. I tell him that the textbooks that were available weren't much good. And he said one day, well, why don't we write one? We enlisted the help of Jack Myers, a plant physiologist with a good background in chemistry. He'd got his PhD at Minnesota, had courses from McDougall. Name's familiar to you. Did some first-rate work back in the early part of the century. Good thermodynamicist and a fellow who really understood the field. So Myers was, although a physiologist, had a lot of chemical background. He agreed to come in on it, and he was to be our sort of perimeter guy, tell us when we're outside the bounds of what the medical students ought to have. We wrote this little book. It was, I don't know, 200-300 pages, I guess. Matt and I wrote it mostly. Our part of it, we wrote out the baseball game. Texas always has had good baseball teams, and we'd go out there and sit in the third base line, and at baseball games you can write and look up, then write again. Myers did his by himself, and we incorporated it. McMillan was interested in it and published it. And I think it was a press run of 5,000, and those were used in about 20 places. We never put out any other editions or anything. But it was an interesting little book in the sense that it tried to tie, at a very early stage, to tie together physiology, biological processes, chemistry, and even theoretical chemistry. It obviously didn't shake the world since it went through one printing, but it was an interesting book. In fact, I've been looking for a copy of it recently. I haven't been able to find it.
Yes, we have a copy at Penn. I looked
at it. Oh, do you?
Yes, I looked at it. It was in the library.
Good. I might go up there and Xerox.
Well, I'll see if we can find a copy for you.
Yeah, all right.
If you're looking for one. I was curious about the response because, as you said, it was very early to be doing that kind of thing.
The students liked it. There isn't much question. I'd been told that it was hard to get the students interested in the field. Even the good these were the good students who signed up for it. But they liked it. As I recall, I gave it, I'd say, 3 years running, something like that, until I became chairman of the department, I believe. There were little or no dropout. There was little or no dropout, and that's a pretty good indication that students like it. I'd say that 30 or 35 people took it each time. The only reason we didn't keep it up to date is that we all had our own things to do. Mattson went on to do a lot of good theoretical work. He's the guy that does spin freak quantum chemistry. Myers is actually a photochemist. His interest was algae, and my corrosion work had taken off, so we just didn't have time to write books.
Let's. There were some other things I wanted to talk about your research, but perhaps since you mentioned it, let's look at your becoming chair of the department in 1952. You'd only been there 7 years. You were only 40 years old, as I got the dates right.
38, I guess. I was born in 1912.
How did that come about?
When I came, Dr. Felsing was chairman. He had been chairman for a while. He was a typical physical chemist, worked, you know, with the thermodynamic systems primarily. And he had chaired the department in a very avuncular fashion. Discipline was a little different in those days, you know, it came up through the chairman. But the chairman was not a head. That was an important distinction. He helped. Kim, we're going to send some annual reports, Dr. Boning, as many as you can find, of the foundation.
Over the past years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't go back to BC, but certainly the last few years are important.
Okay.
And he had been chairman for quite a long time and was tired. He was replaced, or succeeded, not replaced. He was succeeded by Robin Anderson, another physical chemist, who wasn't all that interested in doing the chairmanship. Now, at that time, there were about 15 people in the department faculty. The older ones didn't want to take it on. Anderson didn't want to keep it, and Mattson was clearly not interested in being a chairman. And while I wasn't particularly interested in being, I didn't mind it. So it sort of fell on me. But it was kind of an important thing for me because it crystallized some stuff that I didn't know I could do or wanted to do. Management capability was one of the things. You know, I had no management background of any sort, but organization in my own business was always the first thing, so that's what happened to that department. And the department, which had been run in a kind of, as I said, in a avuncular fashion, I began to run in a more organized fashion. Careful not to step on the toes of the faculty. But, for example, I walked down into the tunnels in the sub-basement of the chemistry building, which by that time was about 25, 30 years old. I walked back in the tunnels and found the remnants of a system, which is kind of interesting, just boxes and boxes of Jena glass, beakers, flasks, sidearm flasks, funnels. You want to send them.
Send them?
Mail them.
Okay.
Sidearm flasks, all sorts of glassware, which came about because at that time, any money you had left over at the end of the fiscal year, state fiscal year, you spent. Otherwise, you had to give it back. And the way to spend it was to buy chemical equipment. That is, you didn't throw it away. And Jena glass, I guess, was popular in the late 30s or early 40s, maybe. Mm-hmm. In the interim between soft glass and Pyrex. And these boxes of things had been bought from Germany and stored down there. Just literally scores of them. But while I was fooling around down there, I found bottles of mercury, lots of them, full of mercury, and pieces and bits of silver and gold and platinum, which had been used in laboratory, in the physical lab, for example, analytical lab. And I therefore made a very thorough search of the place by myself and collected the mercury and the metals and sold them. I think it was legitimate. I sold them, and I had about $10,000 out of the sale. And for the first time, I had money to support research of the faculty members in the department, and gave them each whatever it was, $1,000, I guess. And that was kind of unheard of at the time, because you bought things out of MO&E, maintenance, something and equipment, for your classes, and you sponged off of that. That's the way you did your research. If you needed glass, you'd go to the freshman lab and get tubing. The research activity was pretty high. That's the reason I went to Texas. When I went down there, I saw about all the dozen or so faculty members had some research activity going on. Felsing was a set of physical chemistry. He did a lot of work with vacuum systems. He was constantly in the laboratory with his own torch, you know. You've seen. And the torch was bought either with his own money or was bought for the physical chemistry lab, and he was using it. Or both. At any rate, this money was the first time, as far as I knew, that people there had their own dough to buy what they needed or what they wanted in the way of generally chemicals and glassware for their own research laboratory. So I became a very popular chairman pretty quick. The quick way to become popular official is to support something with money. Mr. Bush is finding that out now. So anyway, that worked out very well. And I continued that investigation. I then went up into the attic and found that it was a shambles, a very dangerous place. It was just full of abandoned materials. Dr. Lochte, for example, used to get crude oil and extractor for naphthenic acids with for the naphthenic acid it contained, and the residue would go up in the attic. you've been down here in the summer, you know, it's not cold up there, I'll tell you. And I'm reasonably sure that we were lucky that we went past the flashpoint of some of those things. What may have happened is that it evaporated during the colder weather. The volatiles went off, and maybe we looked out that way. At any rate, I went up there and then decided there were a lot of things there that were useful, but I couldn't get to them. Physically couldn't get to them. So I scared the administration by telling them that they had a very unsafe building, and they sent the crew over and cleaned out the place, and we got more mercury and other metals. So I had a little cache of cash, which I was able to use for the second and third year. By that time, this was 52, 53, I had had a grant, you know, that I got in 46, and that kept on going. Other members of the faculty began to get research grants. And so I could step out gracefully and not support them any further. But for 2 years, I got them used to financial support, and then they went off and did their thing with grant proposals.
What kind of sources of money were available in those days, externally?
Well, ONR had started. By 1954, NSF had started. In fact, this place started in 54, the Wells Foundation. And then IH was already underway. So basically, they were able to do it. In addition to that, Roger Williams, who headed up the Biochemical Institute, had made an arrangement with the Clayton Foundation for the support of his biochemists. I think there were maybe four or five. By that time, the faculty was at 20, and four or five of them were biochemists. And the Clayton Foundation provided the support for all of those biochemists with a proviso that they don't go outside and try to get any other. In other words, it was an operating foundation. They literally paid half their salary and all their support, all their research support. So there were a fair number of sources, and if you're interested, able, and really aggressive, you could do pretty well. ONR, NIH, MSF, the Wells Foundation, and I believe the Office of Army Research, as it was called at the time, started about the middle 50s. And toward the end of the 50s, the AFOSR started. And the AEC, you know, because Dr. Watt and Dr. Morgan, both inorganic chemists, and Watt had been with Seaborg at Chicago, and Morgan, as a matter of fact, had gone up there also, and then went and got his PhD with Seaborg at Berkeley, radio chemist. So they had AEC money.
What was the age distribution in the department at that time? Were there more younger faculty, or were the older faculty still dominant?
There were 1, 2, 3. Of the, say, 15 when I became chairman, 6 were what you'd call older faculty. If I were to be included amongst the middle group, there were about 5 of us and 4 rotators. We brought a lot of people in during the decade of the 50s. Didn't keep a whole lot of them on purpose. That is, we didn't do so well bringing them in. I guess that's the problem. And we did indeed contribute to the problem of publisher perish. Now, I don't think there's any question about that. Grants at that time, by the middle 50s, I had one for 10 years. And Mattson and I were consultants. He had a then Humble company, and I had a Mobile. And others began to do the same thing. So the sort of exfoliation from the department to the world had begun. And this may sound like old fogyism, but it's gone too far. Mm. Because he and I and the others there did not let the outside interest influence the inside stuff. We did indeed spend a lot of time with students. And in fact, till I became chairman, I taught either three or four classes every semester, as did all the rest of them. When I became chairman, I went down to two. I taught freshman chemistry every year from the time I got there to the time I left in 1970. The 8 o'clock class, freshman class in the morning, was mine. Big one, 250 to 500. And then I taught a graduate class. It was either surface chemistry or electrochemistry. They would alternate. Matson taught freshmen quantum mechanics, statistical mechanics, things of that sort. So I've sometimes charged with leading the charge off the campus. Probably true, but that was not the intent. The intent was to broaden our view of the system. As you well know, the faculty members were pretty well involuted. Mm-hmm. And outside, the industrial people looked on them as being fuzzy-haired or egghead or whatever term was it. Egghead, I think it was. Stevenson was around. Adlai Stevenson was around at the time. And I thought that my contact with Mobil and other companies after a while, Dow and Carbide and lots of others, made me a better chemist. Maybe not from the point of view of chemical theory, but from the point of view of chemical use. And I still think so. But I'm of the opinion that you can do that and your research and be interested in the students, and that those were synergistic one with the other. Now, I'm afraid the tendency is I'm now so busy doing outside things, I got to minimize my inside things. I think it's about to turn around again. But
I remember Farrington Daniels, I believe, taught freshman chemistry for many, many years.
Yeah,
as did. Well, with that same intent in mind.
Yeah.
That it required the best people to be in that freshman chemistry course.
Yeah, my philosophy was you could put a graduate student to teaching graduate courses, because graduate students in the graduate courses had to learn it by themselves anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't matter. I don't mean you neglect graduate students by any means. My procedure for dealing with the graduate students was primarily in bull sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Without formality, without the threat of examination and that kind of thing. But I thought the full faculty members ought to teach the undergraduates. And that we did. I would say that those who didn't show a bent for it, we got them out of there. But the rest of them all taught. Dr. Felsing taught freshmen. Dr. Henze, who was a senior guy when I got there, taught. Williams didn't. Dr. Williams, I don't think could teach freshman chemistry. He taught sophomore organic, which is the equivalent. So it worked out pretty well.
Do you think that, what was the department more physically oriented? Did it have a strength as in one specific discipline of chemistry?
It was, as most of the departments were at the time, organically oriented. It had a very strong bias toward biochemistry because of Roger Williams, who himself was an organic chemist, sort of turned biochemist. and who never, who was always interested in biochemistry, staying in that department. He was a dead set against separation, which was taking place fairly regularly at that time. He said chemistry was what he wanted, not bio. So he was an important influence, and the younger organic, not the younger, the other organic chemists, Henze and Lochte, were typical synthesis people or organic analytical people. The physical chemists were able, but there wasn't a great reputation at Austin. That reputation began to be made in the 50s, and it involved the strong input of the inorganic chemists who were there at the time, particularly Morgan, who was labeled an inorganic chemist, but whose interests were really largely physical. Mattson had begun to make a good reputation in theoretical chemistry. My electrochemical work was going well, and so we began to attract young physical chemists. But it actually wasn't until the 60s when we brought W.A. Noyes down. He had retired at Rochester. He came down, and we sort of put into his hands the identification and the sequestering of good young physical chemists, and he did a great job. From the time he got there until he died, which must have been about 70, 71. The department grew rather rapidly from 52 to the time I left, 70. When I left, there were probably 35 or 40 people in the department. The fields had spread and now had begun to really lap over in the chemical engineering part, the biochemistry, and the biology in part. Well, I guess one place we really weren't successful, we never could convince the geologists to go strongly into geochemistry. Mm-hmm. They were good field geologists, but they weren't all that interested in basic science. Now they're quite different.
I must have been a strong petroleum connection then with the geology department.
Yeah. Mining in general. Of course, there'd been some, you know, there was mining out in the western part of the state in the early years, early part of the century. But petroleum was the main thing. But the chemistry department began to make a reputation that spread it, you know, moved it from the bottom first 100 to the top part of the first 100, I'd say 20, 30, 35. And from 1970 on, it grew even faster and better. But it got a real spurt in the middle 50s.
In your list of publications, there were a couple that you had identified, well, there were several that you had identified as being important ones. And I'm just looking again at this period for up to 61 while you were chairman of the department. Action of polar organic inhibitors and acid dissolution of metals.
Yeah, the reason I thought that was an important one was less because of its importance in corrosion than because of its importance in interface science. You got to remember, back at that time, the corrosion inhibition was looked upon as anything you could do to put a three-dimensional structure between the metal and the solution, whether it was a paint foam or scale or enamel, anything that would just separate the two. That's perfectly legitimate. That worked all right. But it didn't explain the influence of the organic inhibitors, which had been used from time immemorial. As a matter of fact, people used to dump egg white in, or molasses, or all kinds of things early in the 19th century, which clearly depended on the certain organic constituents of those natural materials. Back in the 40s, Darcy Schock and I worked on a little problem which came to me from the NGAA, the Natural Gasoline Association of America, I think it's called. A fellow by the name of Tom Bacon of Lone Star Gas Company had a problem, and he had heard that somebody in Austin, he was in Dallas, somebody in Austin was working in the field of corrosion and corrosion inhibition. And he came down to see me one day, and his problem was that the Lone Star Gas Company had a couple of wells out in Opelika Field, which was about 100 miles east of Dallas. I forget what it was near. And the problem was that they had two wells sitting fairly close to each other. These were condensate wells, natural gas condensate wells. And one of them, the Tullis number two, gave them all kinds of trouble, but Tullis number one was fine. And they just didn't understand it. And they wondered if I would be interested in trying to help them understand it. Well, that was fairly new. I was already consulting for Mobil, but that was different. I'd go to Mobil and listen to their problems and let them talk until they found the solutions and then go home. This was to help this fellow Bacon find out what was wrong. And I thought a long time about it, but then I decided, well, I wouldn't put a lot of time in on it, but I'd go out and see what was up. At any rate, Schock had been a graduate student of mine. Who couldn't pass organic, so the organic prelim just killed him. So he stopped with a master's degree, and we opened this corrosion research lab out of what was the old magnesium plant, currently the back Alconi's Research Center. And this was an ideal problem for him. It required an understanding of the system. It wasn't a degree program. So in essence, the first of the research assistants appeared that way. Again, it was moving the university into what it's now doing, perhaps more than it should, but it's doing it. Anyway, we decided that the way to find out what was going on was to expose some coupons in the flow line of the two wells. And we did. Sure enough, the coupon in the Tullis number one corroded very rapidly. that told us number two didn't. And when we looked at these with what now appears to be very unsophisticated instrumentation, it was sophisticated, but with optical systems interference things. We detected a film on the one that didn't grow, but a thin film. It didn't alter the appearance of the metal, for example. You still got the iron, the steel color through. And the other one didn't have anything like that. It was very rough and corrugated and so on. And my first statement to Bacon was, you might have the same name on both of these, but they're not coming from the same horizon. I was naive enough to believe that those guys knew everything there was to know about the field, but the fact is they didn't know a damn thing about it. When they decided to test my proposition, turns out they weren't from the same horizon. They were at the same depth, mm-hmm. but the horizon dipped. So that was the first thing. The second thing, second thing I suggested to them they wouldn't do, namely take the flow from Tullis number two and take it down below and bring it up. Because I propositioned them that there was a natural inhibitor in this Tullis number two horizon. And that's when I got interested in it, because I went to Dr. Lochte, who I told you was an organic chemist, and he did a lot of extraction of things from crudes. And he suggested that maybe naphthenic acids. And so we began to do some studies on naphthenic acids, and sure enough, we could reproduce those films easily. That was the principal contribution of the Corrosion Research Laboratory. Because from there on, I got quite interested in this business of organic materials in low concentrations and the influence they had on the metal interface, metal solution interface. I then ran across an article which was not in the scientific literature but in the technical literature, which described the introduction of toluidines into a system that was corroding petroleum system, the water from a petroleum system. And the toluidines were found to be different from one another. Ortho-toluidine being much more effective than either para, meta, or toluene. And it was known as the ortho effect. And that's all. It was dropped right there, you know. The guy, I think somebody out of Tulsa, maybe City Service or whoever was in there, or Exxon's lab was sort of up there. And I wondered, why was the ortho position so important? I got us started on the interest and structure of the organic material and the way in which it disposed itself on the metal surface, on the interface. Now, the reason that paper was important is that by the time that paper came along, I was convinced that while these may not be great commercial inhibitors, there were distinct differences which were structurally related, and that had to depend on either of several possibilities, some combination, namely on the what I'll call the Lewis acid base characteristic. In most cases, these were electron donors. Or on its capacity to cover, which meant you had to know something about the architecture. And I began to be interested now in chemisorption rather than the physical sorption. So it was before others had talked about it, or it was in the early days, I began to think in terms of two-dimensional compounds on the interface. And this was an obvious this has an obvious involvement with catalysis and a whole lubrication, a whole bunch of interfacial phenomena. That's why I thought that paper was important. In fact, I gave a talk to the New York Academy of Sciences somewhere back in that time, in which I talked about two-dimensional compounds, and I got hooted at that. Guys didn't think it was the kind of thing to talk about. It was too fanciful. Not fancy. But that was in the early 50s. And now, of course, you see them. I mean, you do interferometry or you do scanning, tunneling microscopy or something like that, and they're there. But at that time, we had to infer them. And so much of my research then went over to the business of what can you do with molecules that will permit you to make a prediction about what might happen. And that led to a very good series of papers with Aramaki on structures of polymethylene imines.
Oh, yes, there's a number of those.
Yeah.
At the same time that that paper came out, there was another one which fits in with what you're just saying about charge transfer,
yeah.
No bond adsorption.
Yeah, that was before its time, I got to tell you. I think that was published in Journal of Chemical Physics.
I don't have the reference right in front of me.
But
that was 1954.
That was a little early. The response to that was zilch. It's a good paper. Matson and I were on that paper, and my student McCrites, I think, was on that paper. It was before its time, but nonetheless, it did presage what was going to happen in interface science.
I think I have a copy of it here, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, Journal of Chemical Physics. Al McCrites got his degree that year or the year before, maybe. I've got all of them lined up in a file someplace.
Well, around just a little bit after that, you had a patent which struck me as being somewhat out of the line of what you've been doing, and this was a process for de-inking printed white paper.
Actually, it was a little before that. Was it about 49, wasn't it?
This one was 56.
56, I think. Okay.
There was another one that came much later, too.
Yeah. That's right. It was not in line, but it was in line with the proposition that I would take on students who I thought were capable of doing something in the field of interfaces, if they came to me and said this is what they want to work on. And this guy had been in the paper industry, and he had an idea that he wanted to check, and I looked at it, and in fact I felt capable of helping him do it. That was the point. What this was the proposition that the carbon particles adhered to the fiber, paper fiber, in large part electrostatically, and that if you could develop a solution which helped reduce or alter the charge on the carbon particles so that A was the same sign and B had a different value, you could cause them to spring apart by putting them in an electric field. And it worked. We just took a big iron pot and an iron electrode. I guess it was a cathode. The pot was the anode. And the solution, I don't remember, but it was a concoction. And I took newsprint and beat it up put it in there, put the charge across this thing. The solution wasn't a good conductor, so there's a big drop right at the anode, or the electrode. I can't remember if it was the anode or the cathode, not the electrode. And what happened was the carbon just jumped out, mm-hmm. left the white fiber right around the electrode, and all you had to do was draw it off, more stuff would come in. So we got this patent, which I gave to the student, a fellow named Crudel, because it was his idea to begin with. And he tried to sell it to the paper industry. This is the reason I thought it was in the 40s. Maybe by the time it was issued, it was that late.
Mm-hmm. It could have been applied for much earlier.
We tried to sell it to the paper industry at the time because after the war, paper from New Pulp was $200 a ton or something like that. We thought we could do this for about $90 or $100 a ton. But the paper industry, like other old industries, you know, they circled the wagons. They didn't want to hear from us. This was different capital equipment, and recycling was not very popular at the time. You know, you burn the old paper and cut some new trees down, different trees down. Crudel had the patent. I had assigned it to him. He spent a lot of time trying to convince the people in East Texas, for example, to use it. They never did. Mm. It's a good patent.
The two other papers in this time period that you identified, anodic phenomena and an iron electrode.
Yeah. The two interests I had in the field of corrosion, I'm not an engineer, so you know, I'm not really in corrosion as such. One of them was this business of the organic molecules and the way they oriented and the way they bound. And the other was an old interest in passivity. For some reason, while I was at graduate school, I got interested in it. It's a very peculiar phenomenon. I don't know how familiar you are with it. If you take a piece of iron and dip it into concentrated nitric acid, you get a lot of hydrogen coming off, and then it stops. Or if you take a piece of iron and put it into less concentrated nitric acid or even sulfuric and pass current through it, the current stays high, you get to a certain potential, it drops way down and stays that way until you get to what's called the transpassive region, when iron begins to oxidize as FeO4, 2-, at 6 oxidation state. This passivity takes place on iron now with no apparent scale in between the metal and the solution. So whatever is formed is very thin. It has a very peculiar property, that is, it transmits electrons readily. Scale doesn't, you know, scale's an insulator. Iron oxide's either semiconductor or an insulator. And you can destroy it by a variety of things. Chloride does it, for example. Or there's an old experiment known as the Lilly experiment. You take a piece of this, take an iron wire and put it in concentrated nitric acid. Hydrogen comes off momentarily in some brown gas, and it stops. And if you touch the top of it with a piece of copper, you see a pulse run down. It was known as a Lilly nerve model. And I've got an old 8mm movie of the experiments done at Bell Telephone Lab, I guess the early part of the century, I don't know how early it is, in which this Lilly nerve model was demonstrated. Well, anyway, not because the passivation has been destroyed by a pulse of current. I've always been interested in that. As I was in the oxygen electrode back in the 30s, I did a lot of work myself on the oxygen electrode, never solved the problem, but did a lot of work, and got interested in passivity. And I was convinced that there was no scale involved, and the Cambridge school, a guy named Evans, said there was a three-dimensional iron oxide that forms. It had only the peculiarity that was dense. It had very little porosity. And that the reason for the passivation characteristic was just the pure separation of metal and solution. That didn't sound reasonable to me, because the amount of current that flowed through that passive film was too high. You actually could use it, if you were careful, you could use it like an inert electrode. Mm-hmm. So I could do an electrometric titration of a redox couple if I wanted. Had to be very careful. You couldn't have chloride there and some other things. And that meant that current flowed through that thing like it was a metal, or it had to be very thin. It had the same kind of peculiarity that ceramic superconductors had, high-temperature superconductors had. It passed current when it shouldn't have, or by higher than standards. And I gave a paper at I think the first passivity conference, it was called, in Heiligenberg in Germany, in which I suggested that the reason it was so conductive was that the iron oxygen combination formed very rapidly, and the material was amorphous rather than crystalline, and that it spread rather than moving perpendicularly from the surface, it spread laterally across the surface. In a thin, it had to be well packed, it had to be non-porous, of sufficiently thin film so that electrons could move through it readily. And that meant of angstrom type thicknesses. That paper actually got some interest. Carl Wagner, I don't know if the name means anything to you. Wagner was one of the German scientists who was captured and brought over here at the end of the war, put out of Fort Bliss. A very gentle guy whose only interest was science. He had no family, no nothing. Was involved in this Heiligenberg conference, and he got pretty interested in it. My Cambridge buddies jumped up and down on me at that meeting and said that was silly. Anybody knew it had to be iron oxide and had to be three-dimensional, and they could prove it because they would strip it off and show it to you. And I maintained that they were confusing cause and effect. What they stripped off was the stripping solution made iron oxide. We had serious arguments about that. Cause and effect is an interesting thing, by the way. It's what screws up most researchers, not keeping those straight, mm-hmm. including mine, by the way. I don't mean to say other people, not just other people. At any rate, that paper was the last that I really did seriously in passivity. I figured if those jokers couldn't accept what was clear, hell with them. So I haven't done much since then. There was a very good experimental paper I had with Wade. And this was one in which we did potential dynamics before it became a term. We would drive the potential across this passive region, mm-hmm. and then reverse it and come back. And you could make this whole thing reversible if you didn't go too far. If you went too far along that plateau, this was a current plateau, current on the abscissa and potential on the ordinate, and you change the potential and measure the current. You could drive across that plateau, and if you went only a certain fraction of distance, which we thought at one time was critical, but turns out not to be, you could go back and retrace the curve. If you went just a little further, the whole thing dissipated. You'd see the gas begin to form, and you'd go into the transpassive region. That Wade paper was a very good one. Wade, by the way, is a member of the faculty at Austin now.
Well, I did notice the Center for Electrochemical Research listed on the board at the department.
Mm-hmm.
When did that start? Was that much later?
Yeah, that's Alan Bard's.
Okay.
Okay. Stuff.
Yeah. He's on our list to talk to. Also.
Yeah. I was chairman. We brought Bard in. He had been in Lingain's lab. And we brought him in. I brought him in. Because we had an opening in analytical. And I was pretty well convinced from talking to him that he was broader than just pure instrumental analytical. But we put him, and he's still in the analytical division, as a matter of fact. But he obviously is much broader than that.
You had made a comment earlier about the selection of new faculty and the fact that you were either were or were not successful in properly identifying them when they came in. Is there any, I mean, in retrospect, is there any reason for that? Is it in a more general sense, let's look at it in a more general sense. Yeah. How do you identify a person for a slot that you have available in your department?
Well, the standard way, you know, you talk to him, you listen to his supervising professor, and you get recommendations, and you learn pretty quickly that unless somebody dislikes a person, they're always going to be much higher than you can expect out of them. So the question is, what kind of factor can you put on them? And that depends on who it is you're talking to. So you have to now evaluate the recommender rather than the recommendee. Furthermore, in the 50s, Austin was still a pretty isolated place. To get to it, you could fly in, but for example, if you flew down from Boston, you would go to New York, New York to Knoxville, Memphis, Nashville, Dallas, Fort Worth, Waco, Austin. It was not an easy trip, I'll tell you. Or you come by train and take an overnight, and two days and a night. And people on the east and west coasts just weren't that easy to move. You could get the outdoorsman, but then you had a problem as to whether he came because he'd go hunting and fishing eat more readily, or because this guy you wanted. So, what you sort of deliberately had to do was say, look, we know we're not going to get the best guys right at the beginning. What we want are people we can stepladder on. And we were perfectly willing to be lucky, too. It turns out we were lucky in at least two cases that I can think of offhand. One's Bard. Why Bard came down, you'll have to ask him. Because I can't tell. He was in New York born. He went to that New York high school. What's it called? The Bronx High
Bronx
School.
Bronx High School of Science.
He had been picked up from there and went to Harvard. And it seemed to me he had plenty of opportunities. But he did choose to come down there, and it was a great break for us because he's good. The other great break for us was Alan Kelly. Kelly's an inorganic chemist. He's currently a fellow of the Royal Society. He had taken the degree at I think, Imperial College, and was working with ICI when we found out about him. And I happened to be in England, or I happened to be, in fact, it may have been for that passivity conference. I was coming back from Germany. And I talked to him, and he came. And it wasn't as evident at the beginning that that was a great move. He was quite satisfactory, nothing wrong with him, good instructor. But he has developed, he really has a first-class reputation as an inorganic chemist. They came about the same time. And that, I think, literally gave us the step on which we could begin to build with the people that Noyes had in mind, in physical chemistry specifically. But during that same period of time, we must have taken in, I'll say 15 people, and kept those two, plus Nate Bald, who also came from Harvard, plus Steve Weber, and the others we let go.
And when did you bring Noyes down?
In the early 60s. I was actually in the central administration by that time. I don't think I was chairman at the point, but I was involved with it. The major mover in that was George Watt, who was, I think, a counselor of the ACS, and otherwise fairly deeply involved in chemical business, so to speak. And he's the one that ran across who would see Noyes. He was instrumental in convincing. Noyes was retiring at Rochester. Mm-hmm. I suspect the difference between 107 inches of snow and no snow impressed him. Winter, in the winter. And he and his wife had a very pleasant 10 years in Austin. Matter of fact, they're buried there. Mm. Which is kind of interesting.
Oh. Okay. Well, that brings us to a point where you, as you just said, moved into central administration. You indicated earlier that when you became chairman, you realized, without any management background, that you liked doing it and that you found your skills in that. What led to your moving up to the Dean of Research in 1961?
The chemistry department became notable on the campus for being managed well. The administration had fewer problems, no noise out of the place. We were sort of on the forefront of the movement, which was to become part of the world rather than be an ivory tower. We were ahead of Harvard and Yale, for example. Yale still hasn't got to it. But as I said earlier, I'm not sure it hasn't gone too far, but it was important that universities realize that they were not there for totally esoteric reasons. That you had to start thinking in terms of real people rather than fuzzy-cheeked boys and pretty girls and social events and whatnot, you know. Beauty queens, things of that sort. That universities were real and important things in the scheme of things. Chemistry led the way. Some of the others are still kicking and screaming, as a matter of fact. But the administration that time was perceptive enough to recognize that this may be the way of the future, and so they tapped me for some other thing. That, in fact, the first thing I was tapped for was to fill in for the graduate dean, the dean of the graduate school, for 8 or 10 months while he went on leave. And I'm not even sure what date that was, to tell you the truth. But it was in that same region. I took that on along with the chairmanship. I didn't give up chairmanship. And I went over there and found out that you could do that work in 15 minutes a day. It was no great problem. The graduate dean never did forgive me for that. He was polite, but he was cool. And that's where I began to look at structures outside of chemistry. Up to that point, I looked at my dean, or the president, or vice president. I went in the graduate dean's office for the 8 or 10 months, I can't remember how long it was, and recognized that the graduate dean was a horizontal blanket on a vertical system, and therefore couldn't be very powerful. All these vertical arrangements went right to the president, and so he was flanked, just sure as hell. So all he could do was sign diplomas and theses and that kind of dissertation. Had no money. And that's still true, graduate deans are not very powerful. If they have any effect, it's by dint of personality, not by dint of office. So I began to get a little understanding of greater management systems. By that time, the first fellow who had been asked to look at sponsored research, a man named Boner, C.P. Boner, physicist, had more of it than he wanted, and he went back to being director of the Defense Research Laboratory, with which I was involved also, by the way. That was a laboratory that stemmed out of the war. The Harvard Underwater Acoustic Laboratory. They did submarine signals, how to detect them and how to prevent getting the signals out. When the war was over, and he was up there as associate director, Walker, Eric Walker, who was president of Pennsylvania State, was the director of it. Boner was the associate director. When the war was over, the two of them determined that this work should continue. So an underwater sound laboratory appeared at Penn State, and one appeared at Texas, and a third one appeared at Washington. And I can't remember what that connection was. And that became the Defense Research Laboratory of the University of Texas, funded by the Navy, doing classified work, by the way, on the campus. Penn State had the same thing. Their building is right smack in the middle of their campus. I think the Washington one was at Friday Harbor, so it was off campus. And I became associated with DRL as a faculty appointment. And it was important to me because it gave me a chance to put some of my students to work over there. They paid for it. Hello. I did an ACS set of lectures last fall, and I keep getting calls from guys who come down to Texas from Maine. I was doing the Northeast up there. And I was kidding. He said, just call their temperature's 9 degrees in Orono.
I'm enjoying my week down here, too.
Let's see, where were, I was saying something.
We were talking about... you were talking about the Defense Research Laboratory.
Oh, yeah. That was a We hadn't mentioned that. It started right after the war. And I joined it as a kind of a staff guy, probably 47, 48, 49 maybe. It offered me a place to put students that I couldn't support anyway, to do work that I was interested in. And I had, I think, three people who worked over there, got their degrees with me. And in fact, one of them was way off of what I'd been doing here. Hurd, Ray Hurd, did some work on, forget what he did his dissertation with me on. It may have been the iodine reaction, electrochemical iodine reaction.
List here.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about DRL. That was a fairly important part of my early time at Texas.
Those were the days when there was an objection to classified work going on a campus.
No comment, actually. And I was a member of their staff probably until I became vice president when it would have been a conflict.
All right, here's the list I was looking for. Ray Hurd.
When did he get his degree? Say.
No.
It would be in the middle 50s.
Yes, the certain. Papers with his name on, published 51 in 56, 57, 55.
Mm-hmm.
Electrokinetic potentials of bulk
That's
metals.
It. Yeah. See, that was a little beyond what I'd been doing, but what we did over there, I guess it's no longer classified, was something called Solians, S-O-L-I-O-N-S. And the Solians were interesting little devices which came too late because transistors and other things like that. What they were little electrochemical cells with flexible sides and cast in polyethylene, I think. With wires inserted, you know, fused into. There was a platinum membrane with a hole. On this side was a Ki iodine solution of some concentration. On this side was a Ki solution with no iodine in it. This little hole permitted the movement of the concentrated solution through here. And when that concentrated solution came through, it had an electrical bias on it, the current went up. So you could read it. Now, what made it go through? Well, the flexible plastic membrane sitting in the water would pick up the signature of a submarine. The wave would come through, push this thing through, and it would do it in a certain fashion, so you actually got a signature by reading the current. And that's what they were doing. That was the classified work, among other things we're doing. And the question was, what do we know about that system? And one of the things we didn't know was the effect of the motion on that little hole. So Ray and I devised a dissertation topic which was very legitimate, and that is to determine the electrokinetic potential by electroosmotic flow of a platinum tube of about the same dimensions as hole. And it was great because those guys could pay for things like buying a piece of platinum and the instruments that we needed to make measurements and so on. And Ray Hurd was a fellow who had a truly green thumb in research. He could jump to a particular point without intermediate understanding in ways that were hard for most people to do. And that was one of them. He did a fine piece of work. And that electric, and that, I forget where he published that, but it got a lot of attention.
Journal of Electrochemical Society.
Got a lot of attention at the time because it was one of the few papers in electrokinetics that had appeared for a long time. You know, way back there, they'd done some electroosmosis and whatnot. And it was just at the time when people were beginning to get interested in electroosmotic water recovery from seawater.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good piece of work. At any rate, that's what DRL meant to me at the time. It gave me a chance to support some students. Well, at any rate, what I started to tell you was that Bohner, who had been the associate director of the Harvard Underwater Acoustics Laboratory, came back to, he had been a professor of physics at Austin, came back to Austin, became dean and vice president. He became first the director of an office of government-sponsored research. That may or may not have been its exact name. Or director of that. That's right. That's what he did. But he got tired of it and went back to DRL. This fledgling little office, which had two people in it, I think, was therefore unheaded by a faculty member, and that was not thinkable at the time. So I was asked by the then president, who was Logan Wilson, to head it. But then he had the perplexing problem, what do you do with a faculty member and a non-academic title? So they called me Dean of the Office of Government-Sponsored Research. And I had a man there by the name of Jens Jacobson, who was the functional director, and I was the tie to the faculty. I did that for a couple of years, I think, and sort of got the thing established. The reason, and I suspect the reason that that was actually my first administrative job outside the department. The reason they did that was because I'd been the first to have a grant. And by the time I did that, I was 10 or 12 years old. And besides that, I never complained about other jobs. They didn't pay me anymore. Nothing happened except they gave me the title and I ran the office. And I kept my chairmanship and so on. The next step, though, was different.
Mm-hmm. Were you... What was the principal function of this office? To find research opportunity or grant opportunity
no.
for faculty?
No, actually, it's the other way around. It was how to fit this outside perturbation signal into the system without discomforting the system.
Okay.
That's still a problem. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's a bigger problem now. Now the office itself is part of the, this is an opinion, not a fact. The office itself is part of the discomfiture. It has grown to the point where it's a canker in the system. it's not an expediter. It's not a thing that the faculty uses to make themselves feel comfortable. It dictates what the faculty has to do. That's what, there's something wrong with it. Anyway, when we started, principally what we did, my instructions to that little staff was, see what the faculty wants, see if we can do what they want with the money from outside, do your very best to not be bound too much by the rules we already have. But if you can't do it, then just don't take the money. Now, that's unthinkable now. You don't not take money. So that office ran pretty well, mainly because Jacobson was a very able, he's dead now, was a very able guy, mm-hmm. very understanding of the faculty and their needs and desires, and did precisely what I told you. He'd try to make it fit, and if he couldn't, he'd tell all concerned, forget it.
Did this apply outside of the science engineering area, or was it?
At that time, there was nothing outside. The reason I was a little hesitant, there may have been something in psychology. That probably started in the early 60s. They began to get some support. But it didn't apply to anything else, geography, anthropology. Anthropology may have. No, in those early days, anthropology didn't have anything. Social sciences were pretty much excluded. So the answer is it was predominantly science and engineering. And the engineers, who had very quietly consulted for years without ever telling anybody, and in fact using the equipment and the facilities, they weren't supposed to. They may not have known they weren't supposed to. They just used it. Mm-hmm. You know, they do water analyses and things of that sort. Charge $10 for it or something. The engineers didn't really get involved in grant operation, I think, till the middle 60s. I may be wrong about that, but I think that's right. The engineers are operative engineers, not quasi-scientists, as many of them currently are. They got a little upset by the way the scientists were harvesting money and decided to do the same thing. You may remember that the National Science Foundation really didn't have much of an engineering division until late 70s. The engineers really jumped up and down, raised the devil, threatened to have a National Engineering Foundation and so on. The engineers really got their act together in the 70s. So I don't think they had a lot at first. So primarily chemistry, physics, astronomy, not math. You know, math up until the 80s didn't do a whole lot of this kind of stuff.
Computer science was still a fledgling group at that time.
Computer science was a fledgling group, yeah. I'll get to that because I had a big involvement.
Okay.
And astronomy, I had a big involvement. I became an ecumenical scientist when I got into administration.
Well, maybe that's what we should spend the rest of our time on this morning, because you were only in that position a short time when you moved into a much bigger administrative picture in 1961.
Yeah. Yeah, that. What happened in 61 was that Logan Wilson went off to be the president of the American Council on Education in Washington. Harry Ransom, who had been his vice president, became president. By the way, there was a big change already seated at the university. It had become a system without knowing it. University of Texas, if you ask anybody in 1960, you didn't put at Austin, you just said University of Texas. In fact, I still do. But at that time, there was, aside from that campus, there was the Galveston Medical School, thing that was called Texas School of Mines in El Paso. The McDonald Observatory out in West Texas, and a Marine Institute, wasn't called Marine Science Institute at the time, but Marine Institute down on Mustang Island. And I think that, oh, a dental school in Houston. That was the University of Texas group. And the one in Austin was called Maine University. Literally, we referred to it as MU. So the president of the University of Texas had these branches, a few branches, three or four. And the vice president was the inside man charged with budget affairs on the main campus. The dean of the medical school, and he was a dean, not a president, at Galveston. There was a president at El Paso, so it's not a very uniform system. There was a director of the Marine Institute, but there was no director of the observatory. The director of the observatory was the University of Chicago guy. So the president had a vice president. The vice president had a bunch of deans and so on, including this peculiar dean of research. Logan Wilson left to become president of the American Council on Education, which was kind of a step up. And the regents picked Harry Ransom quickly. He, in turn, picked a fellow named Joe Smiley. Who had been dean of the humanities at Urbana, French professor, as his vice president. Well, very shortly after that, the decision was made by the regents that they had to look at the complex as a system. And they decided that there would be a chancellor of the system, and a president of the main university, and a vice president. Ransom was moved up to chancellor. Smiley was moved up to president. That left an opening. And they must have looked around and decided that I'd done all right with the department, with the graduate dean's job for whatever time it was, and the Office of Government Sponsored Research was working, so they asked me if I would do it to the vice president. Now, I'd never given that any thought. I mean, the dean's thing I did, you know, while I was the chairman. I thought being chairman of chemistry is as good as you ought to get, or do. So I said I would do it if they would not keep me from A, teaching my classes, and B, doing my research. Now, they probably thought I was kidding, because they said right away, sure. And so I took it on. And that started in September of 61, I guess. Joe Smiley is a very nice fellow with a good appreciation of what academics were. But he loved a good time. He loved good stories. He just didn't like writing budgets, that's all. And I had learned one of my first great lessons about administration. The budget writer runs the place. I wrote the budget. I came in September 1961 and started on the 1962-3 budget a month later. I had no experience. I didn't know what you do or anything. I had the advantage of a very fine business manager. He was not yet vice president for business, fellow named Colvin, Jim Colvin. And he and I got along very well. He had come there about a year before that, in the first change, when Smiley was vice president. And Jim and I got along very well, still do. And I'm sure he must have helped me over the budget writing process. I don't remember any details, but we got a budget out that first year. And in fact, I was running the university. Mm-hmm. Joe had a fine time. There were no problems between us. We really got along very well. But I learned that big lesson. If you write the budget and know what's in it, you sure as devil also know how to operate the place. And it turns out that Ransom didn't like writing budgets either, by the way. He was interested in library collections and archives. And if you didn't bother him in those three places, you sort of could do what you wanted. So in a sense, I had this whole shebang. Well, '61-'62 was a pretty big year for me. I had a lot of papers out that year. I had a group of maybe 16 to 18 in my lab. Had a big piece of it. I had one, two, three, four big labs. First floor of the chemistry building. By that time, I had an API project, which involved heats of wetting.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And that was, again, an interface problem. And I had started with a fellow named Wang, Hung Lee Wang. I'd been asked by the API, of course, I'd been involved with the petroleum industry as a consultant to Mogul in this much of the corrosion work that I'd done. The API had asked me about what other information could they get that might help them understand wettability of the field rock. I said one of them would be the energy of interaction between water and this and the stuff and oil in that. And so they asked me if I would write a proposal. I did. It became API 46, I think, something like that. And the idea was to build a microcalorimeter. Back then, microcalorimetry was not that simple. It isn't now, but thermal measurements are more sensitive and insulation's easier. But we built a calorimeter. Wang had got his PhD with me some years before. He'd been working at Mobil in Dallas. And he got interested in this program, so we designed and built a calorimeter. And one day he came to me and said he had a call from his father in Shanghai. He was a teacher in Shanghai, saying that he, the son, better get back there or the father would have problems. The son had been a Chinese Air Forceman stationed at Berksman Field in Austin. And when the war was over and he was mustered out, he came over to the department to get a master's degree and chose to work with me. And he's a good, very good guy. He got the master's degree in a year. It was no great problem. Then he decided he wanted to do a PhD, so he stayed and got a PhD with me. And then he went to work with Mobil. He liked it here, didn't want to go back, but and we published a couple of papers. He went back in, I'm not sure when, middle 50s, something like that, late 50s. And I've seen him twice since then. He went back and wrote me a letter a short time after he got there saying he missed his Plymouth. And that he had a job with the Institute for Petroleum Research in Harbin. And that it was awfully cold up there. Then I didn't hear from him for about 20 years. And I suddenly got a letter from him one day in the 70s saying that during the Cultural Revolution he had been on the ground and he'd just gone to work in the field as a peasant. Of course, the guys with degrees were getting their ears chopped off. And that things were better now, and he was back in, he was in a research institute in Beijing, or at that time, Taiping. And that he was enjoying his work. It was an Institute for Chemical Physics, I think it was called. Then he came over here while I was still at Rice, I think about 1981 or two, and he had become director of that institute. And I saw him last about 3 years ago when he gave a lecture at Austin. He was still director but getting ready to retire. So he turned out to be all right. At any rate, the API project then went on with this fellow Bill Wade that I've told you about. He had got his degree with me with that on that passivity work. He went out to Berkeley and worked with Seaborg for about 3 years, I think, 2 or 3 years. And when Wang went back to China, I asked him if he wanted to do a postdoc on the API project, which he did. We published some pretty good papers, as a matter of fact. And of course he was there. He was one of the guys that was picked up and made an assistant professor. There was a little ruckus about that because the faculty didn't really like the idea of former students coming back while they were still an active faculty member of that former student. But they didn't complain too much, and I already had enough managerial weight, so they were careful. So he came back, and he worked his own way through, got tenure. He's currently a professor there. He's a real expert in microemulsions, making and breaking them, so he's maintained his interface chemistry, interface science. He consults all over the world, as a matter of fact.
Well, you had been writing budgets, and I was going to ask you if was that an eye-opener to you to see a much larger budget picture than you had just for the chemistry department?
No. The budgets weren't that much bigger. They were bigger in chemistry, of course, but no, I've had very few surprises in the administrative area. The budget was what I would consider normal. It wasn't distorted particularly. I've never been paranoid about things of that sort. Some people are, you know. Physics gets much more than that. Mm-hmm. See, I quickly came up with a solution to that, that you don't use dollars but dollar equivalents. $1 for a psychologist is $10 for a chemist is $1,000 for a physicist. So the fact that the physicist has $100 more, 100 times more, nothing wrong with that. That's equivalent. And it worked. It kept people from biting my ears off, you know. It's true, as a matter of fact. There are equivalences. The mathematicians, you see, would get their bowels in an uproar. look how much more money you guys get than we get. I'd say, well, you don't need any more to do the same level of work. When it got to the astronomers, I was in trouble. But those simple little things which probably you can do if you take a management course. You know, they've got to be more complex than that. Have helped me, you know, constantly. I've very carefully stayed away from all these charm schools where you go for 6 weeks to learn how to carry on management. I've never been to one. I don't object to other people going to them, but I kind of have a feeling that too much by the book kind of thing. Not for to write my own book, so.
Well, you commented last time, way back in grade school, one of the things you learned at that time was the importance of self-learning.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's been a philosophy of yours for a long time.
And a procedure, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I... The things that you should get from teachers are the enthusiasm, interest. But for the detail, you got to do it for yourself. Anyway, that's the way I learned management, and it worked pretty well. I'm not a hail fellow well met. I don't believe I've ever slapped anybody on the back yet. And I'm not a quick one to call people by their first names as they do now. I find it a little uncomfortable, as a matter of fact. But basically, I am sensitive to people and their needs, whether I think their needs are overblown or not. Their perceived needs. One of the problems with most management is that the manager pays lip service to the person's needs by describing all the good things he does for him or she does for him, but without really having any real feeling about it. My best example of that is not me, but this fellow Calvin I mentioned to you. Calvin was a business, he's retired now, was a business manager in an academic institution, which is kind of an oxymoronish statement because academic institutions are supposed to be non-organized. That's the way thinking gets done, I think. So a guy who's a business manager, which implies high degree of organization, has to deal with an unorganized system. And Calvin was adept at doing that. That is, he knew how to feel what people wanted. And even when he couldn't do anything for them, he made them feel as if he was impressed by their needs. Business managers in general don't do that. They operate by kind of a book. Currently up there, for example, if you need something, you think you need something, you go through a long rigmarole and may or may not get it if you do it a long time after you've forgotten about it. My business manager used to wander the campus himself and see needs and attend to them in a hurry. Well, that's something you don't teach. You have or don't have. You can point out to people that's the way it ought to be done, but many times when they do it because you say that's the way to do it, it is done with discomfort on all sides. So I guess being natural is the important thing. And most people aren't naturally if they operate out of a book. Anyway, those are simple lessons, but they work. And And I also learned that fairness is in the eye of the beholder. It has nothing to do with you, the one who's trying to be fair.
I was going to ask about your relationship with the chemistry department, now that they had one of their own in a much different position.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of... I've been very fortunate with things like that. Ordinarily, they'd say, that son of a gun's gone, you know. Let's use him if we can, but he's not one of us anymore. One of the things we had at 10 o'clock every day, we used to go over and get some coffee, half a dozen of us. Well, I continued doing that out of my other office now. I'd meet them over in the Dragon, and they got pretty used to me. They, you know, there was no trapping. They beat on me then as they used to before, and vice versa. I taught that freshman class every semester. I never took a leave. I've never been on leave. Mm. So I taught every semester at 8 o'clock, and it was a big class. First it was 250 when I was in a room and held 250, and then we moved to another room and had 550. Students were used to me. I was not isolated. I had to go to the class. I had to talk to 550 students and whatever number came up afterwards. I had to walk back across the campus. They got used to seeing me. Until I left Austin, I had somewhere between 10 and 20 people in my lab. So I had to go back there for oral exams and final orals and things of that sort. I was in the department lot. And I'm a restless guy, so I wandered the campus a lot. I'd say to Jim, look, light's been out over there for 3 days. You can go do something about it. So between us, we had a very much hands-on kind of function. And everybody on the campus, I think, considered us as part of the bunch, mm-hmm. rather than they and we. And that made it easier, literally. A lot easier. It was different at Rice. We'll come to that later, maybe. But see, at Rice, I didn't grow up with those people. Mm-hmm. And I was already on a we-they basis when I came. I changed that after a while, but the fact is, they were not used to me. At Austin, they were used to me. There were no ands, ifs, or buts. And the fact that I had to be away to Regents meeting or something like that, that was totally understandable to them. Now they don't know when the guy's away to Regents meeting, because they never see him anyway. It doesn't make any difference. But I went to the gym at 5 o'clock every day and played somebody at squash. I went to the class 8 o'clock Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Occasionally had seminars or actually gave a graduate course or two every once in a while. I was on the campus. When I was on the campus, I was on it. I wasn't in my office. And I think the students and faculty just got used to me. That's the easiest thing. When I appeared at faculty council meetings or at student assembly meetings or whatever they're called, I wasn't from outer space, because they might have seen me that morning in the varsity cafeteria or something.
How did you feel working in this much broader picture, which got even broader in a few more years as you moved up that administrative ladder?
I can't sort of say that I noticed anything. This is one of the few times I've looked backwards. I wasn't following Satchel Paige's admonition, but I've always looked ahead, and so whatever I'm doing is what's natural, and the expansion wasn't noticeable. I guess there were a few things that were noticeable. We had the accident of having a local boy as president of the U.S. So during that period of time, my wife and I were at the White House a few times, which we would not otherwise have been, and that was noticeable. We stayed over there a few nights. We went to a couple there of the state dinners, that kind of thing. By late that decade, I was on the National Science Board, and I began to have contacts in Washington, which I hadn't had before. So that was a change. That was a transition. But the other transitions were not particularly noticeable to me. A, because I didn't look back, and B, because I was just doing what I was doing. And I guess also because I didn't change a whole lot of things. I added a few things, but I still had my class, which is a very, comfortable thing. Still had my graduate students, put out 2 or 3 PhDs a year. Still raised hell getting the papers published. We didn't publish them like they do now, but 6 a year, that wasn't bad.
No.
Roughly, that's what it was.
Well, I can remember getting graduate school brochures from Rice.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And which, in the chemistry department, this was the annual mailing that would go out from to our department up at Wilkes. And, of course, your position at Rice was prominently displayed, and I can remember saying to myself, how do you keep all the balls in the air with all of those, with such a diversity of activity, as you said, teaching and PhD students and writing papers and still doing very high-level administrative mm-hmm. work at the same time?
I don't know. I mean, it just got done. Not that hard. Put a lot of hours in. Actually began to learn how to do things more compactly, as you go on. I've never liked a desk with paper on it, for example. And I learned to come in and go through the stuff in a hurry and get rid of the things that could be done quickly and get it down to the few things that took a little more thought. But proposition is, there are a lot of decisions that you have to make that you can make very rapidly. You're going to be wrong a certain number of times and right a certain number of times. And it doesn't matter how long you take on. The biggest trick is to try to make sure that you got those things out which have down the line importance. Most of them don't. Most of them are simple decisions. Occasionally you run into one that looks simple and isn't. But at least you narrow. I used to have stacks of papers 3 high when I'd come back from Washington, say, after a couple of days. And in about an hour I could get it down to that. And then those I could take with me to home and mm-hmm. look at them a little more carefully. So I did develop some procedures that permitted me to speed things up, compact things. I couldn't compact my lectures. I really had to go over them each time because I had different ideas about what I wanted to say to them. Couldn't do a whole lot about I could do something about my graduate students. I could point out to them that, look, I'll wander in here, but when we talk, we better say something significant or I'll go on to somebody else. I don't know. I every once in a while I wonder myself, because since, along with all the things you said, I had a lot of activity in Washington. When I first came to Rice, I was on the National Science Board, within 4 years I was chairman. So I spent a lot of time in Washington. Or going back and forth, as a matter of fact. I guess maybe we better...
Well, maybe if we could just spend a few minutes, I'd like to at least finish up here looking at that progression of positions. You became vice president in 61 and then vice chancellor for academic affairs in 63 and then president in 67. So that's a rather rapid progression up the ladder. And if you could talk a little bit about how those changes occurred, why mm-hmm. they occurred.
First, I'll tell you that the change in 63 and 67 were the same change.
Oh, okay.
When Joe Smiley became president of Colorado, he had been the president of Texas for 1 year, 1.5 years. Ransom, who was a chancellor, wanted to change the system. He never had wanted to be chancellor. He wanted to be president of the University of Texas. But he had to defend himself, so he became chancellor. He came to me with a proposition. He said, look, Smiley's leaving. You're vice president. I'm chancellor. Why don't you become vice chancellor for academic affairs for the system? The system by now had grown. It had Arlington in it, it had University of Houston, University of Texas, the Houston Medical Center. It had the Dallas Southwestern Medical Center. It had some others. There were about 10 items in it. It said, why don't you become vice chancellor for academic affairs? I'll be chancellor. We don't need a president. We'll just run it ourselves. Okay. So I had to be concerned about the academic problems for all these branches, which weren't difficult to do. I had to go travel to them. But I also had all the activity of the Austin campus. I wrote the budget, for example. Mm-hmm. Ransom was not interested in that. What he was interested in was protecting archives, Humanities Research Center and the library. And we came to an agreement early that I wasn't going to impact those. I was interested in the library myself. Archives and the Humanities Research Center, less so. But the library is obviously a core of the university. And so we went along for 4 years that way, with me taking care of all the academic affairs of all the campuses, plus what would be the presidency of Austin. And by virtue of being a vice chancellor for academic affairs, I sat along with the chancellor on all the region's meetings, open or closed session, didn't matter, executive session, all of them. When Frank Irwin became chairman of the board, he became concerned. He said, you know, we really ought to have a president here, a guy named president. Well, that's fine. They got a search committee, and the search committee said, well, let Hackerman do it. He said, do you want to do it? I said, okay. And so I became president. But the minute I became president, I could no longer sit inside the region's meetings. Because I was not system staff.
Right, right.
I now had to sit in the anteroom until they called me. I hadn't realized that. But I also didn't have the other problems, so I became president in name. But I had done all of
been
it.
Doing it. Okay.
Yeah. Actually, it was a diminution of things I had to do because I didn't have to worry about El Paso anymore or Dallas or anything else. And now there was another vice chancellor for academic affairs, you see. In principle, I had to deal with him, but I'd begun to acquire power of my own. And I had acquired enough power so I didn't have to worry about the vice chancellor of academic affairs. it's kind of interesting, all those things piled up, all the activities, and I don't remember ever being very stressed by demands. One thing, I didn't accept them. I did it my way, and it worked out pretty well. But when I finished with all that, then I had a problem, because then I didn't have that many demands on my time. So I've had to pile a lot of things together, but that's a later story.
Okay, well, I guess maybe this would be a point for us to stop then.
Yeah.
And thank you again for spending a couple hours with me.
Well, I tell you, it's actually a pleasure, because you're making me recall things I'd forgotten.
Well, I'm glad.